Disc 4.
The next lousy idea involved a conspiracy with his secretary, a woman he trusted marginally to begin with. He would tell her the truth, then ask her to write a letter to Ricky and break the news of Quince Garby's suicide. Together, Quince and his secretary could scheme and fake their way through a suicide, and in the process take some measure of revenge against Ricky. But he'd rather be dead than tell his secretary. The third idea occurred after the Valium had settled in at full throttle, and it made him smile. Why not try a little honesty? Write a letter to Ricky and plead poverty. Offer another $10,000 and tell him that's all. If Ricky was determined to destroy him, then he, Quince, would have no choice but to come after Ricky. He'd inform the FBI, let them track the letters and the wire transfers, and both men would go down in flames. He slept on the floor for 30 minutes, then gathered his jacket, gloves, and overcoat. He left the house without seeing the maid. As he drove to town, flush with the desire to confront the truth, he admitted aloud that only the money mattered. His father was 81. The bank was worth at least $8 million. Someday it would be his. Stay in the closet until the cash was in hand, then live any way he damned well pleased. Don't screw up the money. Coleman Lee owned a taco hut in a strip mall on the outskirts of Gary, Indiana, in a section of town now ruled by the Mexicans. Coleman was 48, with two bad divorces decades earlier, no children, thank God. Because of all the tacos, he was thick and slow, with a drooping stomach and large, fleshy cheeks. Coleman was not pretty, but he was certainly lonely. His employees were mainly young Mexican boys, illegal immigrants, all of whom he sooner or later tried to molest or seduce, or whatever you'd call his clumsy efforts. Rarely was he successful, and his turnover was high. Business was slow, too, because people talked, and Coleman was not well regarded. Who wanted to buy tacos from a pervert? He rented two small boxes at the post office at the other end of the strip mall, one for his business, the other for his pleasure. He collected porno and gathered it almost daily from the post office. The mail carrier at his apartment was a curious type, and it was best to keep some things as quiet as possible. He strolled along the dirty sidewalk at the edge of the parking lot, past the discount stores for shoes and cosmetics, past a XXX video dive he'd been banned from, past a welfare office, one brought to the suburbs by a desperate politician looking for votes. The post office was crowded with Mexicans taking their time because it was cold out. His daily haul was two hardcore magazines sent to him in plain brown wrappers and a letter which looked vaguely familiar. It was a square yellow envelope, no return address, postmarked in Atlantic Beach, Florida. Ah, yes, he remembered as he held it. Young Percy in rehab. Back in his cramped little office between the kitchen and the utility room, he quickly flipped through the magazines, saw nothing new, then stacked them in a pile with 100 others. He opened the letter from Percy. Like the two before, it was hand-printed and addressed to Walt, a name he used to collect all his porn, Walt Lee. Dear Walt, I really enjoyed your last letter. I've read it many times. You have a nice way with words. As I told you, I've been here for almost 18 months, and it gets very lonely. I keep your letters under my mattress, and when I feel really isolated, I read them over and over. Where did you learn to write like that? Please send another one as soon as possible. With a little luck, I'll be released in April. I'm not sure where I'll go or what I'll do. It's frightening, really, to think that I'll just walk out of here after almost 2 years and have no one to be with. I hope we're still pen pals by then. I was wondering, and I really hate to ask this, but since I have no one else, I'll do it anyway, and please feel free to say no. It won't hurt our friendship. But could you loan me $1,000? They have this little book and music shop here at the clinic, and they let us buy paperbacks and CDs on credit, and, Well, I've been here so long that I've run up quite a tab. If you can make the loan, I'd really appreciate it. If not, I completely understand. Thanks for being there, Walt. Please write me soon. I treasure your letters. Love, Percy. $1,000? What kind of little creep was this? Coleman smelled a con. He ripped the letter into pieces and threw them in the trash. $1,000, he mumbled to himself, reaching for the magazines again. Curtis was not the real name of the jeweler in Dallas. Curtis worked fine when corresponding with Ricky in rehab, but the real name was Van Gates. Mr. Gates was 58 years old, on the surface happily married, the father of three and the grandfather of two, and he and his wife owned 6 jewelry stores in the Dallas area, all located in malls. On paper, they had $2 million, and they'd made it themselves. They had a very nice new home in Highland Park, with separate bedrooms at opposite ends. They met in the kitchen for coffee and in the den for TV and grandkids. Mr. Gates ventured from the closet now and then, always with excruciating caution. No one had a clue. His correspondence with Ricky was his first attempt at finding love through the want ads, and so far he'd been thrilled with the results. He rented a small box in a post office near one of the malls and used the name Curtis V. Cates. The lavender envelope was addressed to Curtis Cates, and as he sat in his car and carefully opened it, he at first had no clue anything was wrong. Just another sweet letter from his beloved Ricky. Lightning hit, though, with the first words. Dear Van Gates, the party's over, pal. My name ain't Ricky, and you're not Curtis. I'm not a gay boy looking for love. You, however, have an awful secret which I'm sure you want to keep. I want to help. Here's the deal. Wire $100,000 to Geneva Trust Bank, Nassau, Bahamas, account number 144-DXN-9593 for Boomer Realty Limited, routing number 392-84422. Do so immediately. This is not a joke. It's a scam, and you've been hooked. If the money is not received within 10 days, I will send to your wife, Ms. Glenda Gates, a little packet filled with copies of all letters, photos, etc. Wire the money, and I'll simply go away. Love, Ricky. With time, Van found the I-635 loop around Dallas, and before long he was on the I-820 loop around Fort Worth, then back to Dallas, driving at exactly 55 in the right-hand lane and oblivious to the traffic stacked up behind him. If crying would help, then he would have certainly had a good one. He had no qualms about weeping, especially in the privacy of his Jaguar, but he was too angry to cry, too bitter to be wounded. And he was too frightened to waste time yearning for someone who did not exist. Action was needed. Quick, decisive, secretive. Heartache, though, overcame him, and he finally pulled onto the shoulder and parked with the engine running. All those wonderful dreams of Ricky, those countless hours staring at his handsome face with his crooked little smile and reading his letters, sad, funny, desperate, hopeful. How could so many emotions be conveyed with the written word? He'd practically memorized the letters. And he was just a boy, so young and virile, yet lonely and in need of mature companionship. The Ricky he'd come to love needed the loving embrace of an older man, and Curtis Van had been making plans for months. The ploy of a diamond show in Orlando while his wife was in El Paso at her sister's. He'd sweated the details and left no tracks. He did finally cry. Poor Van shed tears without shame or embarrassment. No one could see him. The other cars were flying past at 80 miles per hour. He vowed revenge, like any jilted lover. He'd tracked down this beast, this monster who'd posed as Ricky, and broken his heart. When the sobbing began to subside, he thought of his wife and family, and that helped greatly in drying up the tears. She'd get all 6 stores and the $2 million and the new house with separate bedrooms, and he would get nothing but ridicule and scorn and gossip in a town that loved it so. His children would follow the money, and for the rest of their lives his grandchildren would hear the whispers about their grandfather. Back in the right lane at 55, back through Mesquite for the second time, reading the letter again as 18-wheelers roared past. There was no one to call, no banker he could trust to check out the account in the Bahamas, no lawyer to run to for advice, no friend to hear his sorry tale. For a man who'd carefully lived a double life, the money would not be insurmountable. His wife watched every dime, both at home and at the stores, and for that reason Van had long since mastered the scheme of hiding money. He did it with gems, rubies, and pearls, and sometimes small diamonds he placed aside and later sold to other dealers for cash. It was common in the business. He had boxes of cash, shoe boxes neatly stacked in a fireproof safe in a mini storage out in Plano. Post-divorce cash. Cash for the afterlife, when he and Ricky would sail the world and spend it all in one endless voyage. "Son of a bitch," he said through gritted teeth. And again and again. Why not write this con man and plead poverty? Or threaten to expose his little extortion scheme? Why not fight back? Because the son of a bitch knew exactly what he was doing. He'd tracked Van well enough to learn his real name and the name of his wife. He knew Van had the money. He pulled into his driveway, and there was Glenda sweeping the sidewalk. "Where have you been, honey?" she asked pleasantly. "Running errands," he said with a smile. "Took a long time," she said, still sweeping. He was so sick of it. She timed his movements. For 30 years he'd been under her thumb, with a stopwatch clicking in the palm of her hand. He pecked her on the cheek, out of habit, then went to the basement where he locked a door and began to cry again. The house was his prison. With a mortgage of $7,800 a month, it certainly felt like it. She was the guard, the keeper of the keys. His sole means of escape had just collapsed, replaced by a cold-blooded extortionist. Chapter 12. 80 coffins required a lot of space. They were laid in perfect rows, all neatly wrapped in red, white, and blue, all the same length and width. They'd arrived 30 minutes earlier aboard an Air Force cargo plane and were removed with great pomp and ceremony. Almost 1,000 friends and relatives sat in folded chairs on the concrete floor of the hangar and stared in shock at the sea of flags arranged before them. They were outnumbered only by the shaggy dogs, all quarantined behind barricades and military police. Even for a country well accustomed to foreign policy boondoggles, it was an impressive body count. 80 Americans, 8 Brits, 8 Germans, no French because they'd been boycotting Western diplomatic functions in Cairo. Why were 80 Americans still in the embassy at 10 p.m.? That was the question of the hour, and so far no good answer had surfaced. So many of those who made such decisions were now lying in their coffins. The best theory, buzzing around D.C., was that the caterer had been late, and the band even later. But the terrorists had proved all too well that they would strike at any hour, so what difference did it make how late the ambassador and his wife and their staff and colleagues and guests wanted to party? The second great question of the hour was just exactly why did we have 80 people in our embassy in Cairo to begin with? The State Department had yet to acknowledge the question. After some mournful music from an Air Force band, the president spoke. His voice broke, and he managed to summon a tear or two, But after 8 years of such theatrics, the act had worn thin. He'd already promised revenge many times, so he dwelt on comfort and sacrifice and the promise of a better life in the hereafter. The Secretary of State called the names of the dead, a morbid recitation designed to capture the gravity of the moment. The sobbing increased. Then some more music. The longest speech was delivered by the Vice President, fresh from the campaign trail and filled with a newly discovered commitment to eradicate terrorism from the face of the earth. Though he'd never worn a military uniform, he seemed eager to start tossing grenades. Lake had them all on the run. Lake watched the grim ceremony while flying from Tucson to Detroit, late for another round of interviews. On board was his pollster, a newly acquired magician who now traveled with him. While Lake and his staff watched the news, the pollster worked feverishly at the small conference table upon which he had 2 laptops, 3 phones, and more printouts than any 10 people could digest. The Arizona and Michigan primaries were 3 days away, and Lake's numbers were climbing, especially in his home state where he was in a dead heat with the long-established frontrunner, Governor Terry of Indiana. In Michigan, Lake was 10 points down, but people were listening. The fiasco in Cairo was working beautifully in his favor. Governor Terry was suddenly scrambling for money. Aaron Lake was not. It was coming in faster than he could spend it. When the vice president finally finished, Lake left the screen and returned to his leather swivel recliner and picked up a newspaper. A staff member brought him coffee, which he sipped while watching the flatlands of Kansas 8 miles below him. Another staff member handed him a message, one that was supposed to require an urgent call from the candidate. Lake glanced around the plane and counted 13 people, pilots not included. For a private man who still missed his wife, Lake was not adjusting well to the complete lack of privacy. He moved with a group, with every half hour slotted by someone, every action coordinated by a committee, every interview preceded by written guesses about the questions and suggested responses. He got 6 hours each night alone in his hotel room, and damned if the Secret Service wouldn't sleep on the floor if he'd allow it. Because of the fatigue, he slept like an infant. His only true moments of quiet reflection occurred in the bathroom, either in the shower or on the toilet. But he wasn't kidding himself. He, Aaron Lake, quiet congressman from Arizona, had become an overnight sensation. He was charging while the rest were faltering. Big money was aimed at him. The press followed like bloodhounds. His words got repeated. He had very powerful friends, and as the pieces were falling in place, the nomination looked realistic. He hadn't dreamed of such things a month earlier. Lake was savoring the moment. The campaign was madness, but he could control the tempo of the job itself. Reagan was a 9-to-5 president, and he'd been far more effective than Carter, an avid workaholic. Just get to the White House, he told himself over and over, suffer these fools, gut it through the primaries, endure with a smile and a quick wit, and one day very soon he'd sit in the Oval Office alone with the world at his feet. And he would have his privacy. Teddy sat with York in his bunker, watching the live scene from Andrews Air Force Base. He preferred York's company when things were rough. The accusations had been brutal. Scapegoats were in demand, and many of the idiots chasing the cameras blamed the CIA, because that's who they always blamed. If they only knew. He'd finally told York of Lufkin's warnings, and York understood completely. Unfortunately, they'd been through this before. When you police the world, you lose a lot of cops. And Teddy and York had shared many sad moments watching the flag-covered coffins roll off the C-130s, evidence of another debacle abroad. The Lake Campaign would be Teddy's final effort at saving American lives. Failure, though, seemed unlikely. Deepak had collected $20 million in 2 weeks and was in the process of hauling the money around Washington. 21 congressmen had been recruited for lake endorsements at a total cost of $6 million. But the biggest prize so far was Senator Britt, the ex-candidate, the father of a little Thai boy. When he abandoned his quest for the White House, he owed close to $4 million, with no viable plan to cover his deficit. Money tends not to follow those who pack up and go home. Elaine Tiner, the lawyer running Deepak, met with Senator Britt. It took her less than an hour to cut the deal. Deepak would pay off all his campaign debts over a 3-year period, and he would make a noisy endorsement of Aaron Lake. "Did we have a projection of casualties?" York asked. After a while, Teddy said, "No." Their conversations were never hurried. "Why so many?" "Lots of booze. Happens all the time in the Arab countries. Different culture. Life is dull. So when our diplomats throw a party, they throw a good one. Many of the dead were quite drunk." Minutes passed. "Where's Hidal?" asked York. "Right now he's in Iraq. Yesterday, Tunisia." "We really should stop him." "We will. Next year. It'll be a great moment for President Lake." 12 of the 16 congressmen endorsing Lake wore blue shirts, a fact that was not lost on Elaine Tiner. She counted such things. When a D.C. politician got near a camera, odds were he'd put on his best blue cotton shirt. The other four wore white. She arranged them before the reporters in a ballroom of the Willard Hotel. The senior member, Representative Thurman of Florida, opened things up by welcoming the press to this very important occasion. Working from prepared notes, he offered his opinions on the current state of world events, commented on things in Cairo and China and Russia, and said that the world was a lot more dangerous than it looked. He rattled off the usual statistics about our reduced military. Then he launched into a long soliloquy about his close friend Aaron Lake, a man he'd served with for 10 years and knew better than most. Lake was a man with a message, one we didn't particularly want to hear, but a very important one nonetheless. Thurman was breaking ranks with Governor Terry, and though he did so with great reluctance and no small feeling of betrayal, he had become convinced through painful soul-searching that Aaron Lake was needed for the safety of our nation. What Thurman didn't say was that a recent poll showed Lake becoming very popular back in Tampa, St. Pete. The mic was then passed to a congressman from California. He covered no new territory but rambled for 10 minutes anyway. In his district, north of San Diego, were 45,000 defense and aerospace workers, and all of them, it seemed, had written or called. He'd been an easy convert. The pressure from home, plus $250,000 from Miss Tiner and Deepak, and he had his marching orders. When the questions started, the 16 bunched together in a tight little pack, all anxious to answer and say something, all afraid their faces might not get wedged into the picture. Though there were no committee chairmen, the group was not unimpressive. They managed to convey the image that Aaron Lake was a legitimate candidate, a man they knew and trusted, a man the nation needed, a man who could be elected. The event was well staged and well covered, and instantly made news. Elaine Tiner would trot out 5 more the following day, then save Senator Britt for the day before Big Super Tuesday. The letter in Ned's glove box was from Percy, young Percy in rehab, who got his mail through Laurel Ridge, Post Office Box 4585, Atlantic Beach, Florida 32233. Ned was in Atlantic Beach, had been for 2 days, with the letter and with the determination to track down young Percy, because he smelled a hoax. He had nothing better to do. He was retired with plenty of money, no family to speak of, and besides, it was snowing in Cincinnati. He had a room at the Sea Turtle Inn on the beach, and at night he hit the bars along Atlantic Boulevard. He'd found 2 excellent restaurants, crowded little places with lots of young, pretty girls and boys. He had discovered Pete's Bar and Grill a block away, and for the last 2 nights he'd staggered from the place, drunk on cold drafts. The Sea Turtle was just around the corner. During the day, Ned watched the post office, a modern brick and glass government job on First Street, parallel to the beach. A small windowless box midway from the floor, 4585 was on a wall with 80 others in an area of medium traffic. Ned had inspected the box, tried to open it with keys and wire, and had even asked questions at the front desk. The postal workers had been most unhelpful. Before leaving the first day, he had stuck a 2-inch strand of thin black thread to the bottom of the box's door. It was imperceptible to anyone else, but Ned would know if the mail was checked. He had a letter in there, in a bright red envelope, one he'd mailed 3 days earlier from Cincinnati, then raced it south. In it, he sent Percy a check for $1,000, money the boy needed for a set of artist supplies. In an earlier letter, Ned had revealed that he had once owned a modern art gallery in Greenwich Village. It was a lie, he had not. But he doubted everything Percy said, too. Ned had been suspicious from the beginning. Before he answered the solicitation, he had tried to verify Laurel Ridge, the fancy detox unit supposedly holding Percy. There was a telephone, a private number he'd been unable to pry out of directory assistance. There was no street address. Percy had explained in his first letter that the place was top secret because many of its patients were high-powered corporate executives and top-level government officials, all of whom had, in one way or another, succumbed to chemicals. It sounded good. The boy had a way with words. And a very pretty face. That's why Ned kept writing. The photo was something he admired every day. The request for money had caught him by surprise, and since he was bored, he decided to make the drive to Jacksonville. From his spot in the parking lot, low behind the steering wheel of his car, with his back to First Street, he could watch the wall of boxes and the postal customers as they came and went. It was a long shot, but what the hell? He used a small pair of foldable binoculars and on occasion caught a stare from someone walking by. The task grew monotonous after 2 days, but as the time passed, he became more and more convinced that his letter would be retrieved. Surely someone checked the box at least once every 3 days. A rehab clinic with patients would get plenty of mail, wouldn't it? Or was it simply a front for a con man who dropped by once a week to check his traps? The con man showed up late in the afternoon of the 3rd day. He parked a Beetle next to Ned, then ambled into the post office. He wore wrinkled khakis, white shirt, straw hat, bow tie, and had the disheveled air of a would-be beach bohemian. Trevor had enjoyed a long midday break at Pete's, then slept off his liquid lunch with an hour nap at his desk, and was just stirring about, making his rounds. He put the key in box 4585 and removed a handful of correspondence, most of it junk mail, which he threw away as he flipped through the letters on his way out of the building. Ned watched every move. After 3 days of tedium, he was thrilled that his surveillance had paid off. He followed the Beetle, and when it parked and the driver walked into a small, run-down law office, Ned drove away, scratching his temple, repeating out loud, "A lawyer?" He kept driving, down Highway A1A, along the shore, away from the sprawl of Jacksonville, south through Villano Beach and Crescent Beach and Beverly Beach and Flagler Beach, and finally to a Holiday Inn outside Port Orange. He went to the bar before he went to his room. It wasn't the first scam he'd flirted with. In fact, it was the second. He'd sniffed the other one out, too, before any damage was done. Over his third martini, he swore it would be his last. Chapter 13. The day before the Arizona and Michigan primaries, the Lake campaign unleashed a media blitz, the likes of which had never been seen before in presidential politics. For 18 hours, the two states were bombarded with one ad after another. Some were 15 seconds, little softies, with not much more than his handsome face and the promises of decisive leadership and a safer world. Others were one-minute documentaries on the dangers of the post-Cold War. Still others were macho, in-your-face promises to the terrorists of the world, kill people simply because they are Americans, and you will pay a very dear price. Cairo was still very fresh, and the assurances hit their mark. The ads were bold, put together by high-powered consultants, and the only downside was oversaturation. But Lake was too new to the scene to bore anyone, not now, anyway. His campaign spent $10 million on television in the two states, a staggering amount. They ran at a slower clip during voting hours on Tuesday, February 22nd, and when the polls closed, the exit analysts predicted Lake would win his home state and run a close second in Michigan. Governor Terry, after all, was from Indiana, another Midwestern state, and he'd spent weeks in Michigan during the previous 3 months. Evidently, he hadn't spent enough time there. The voters in Arizona opted for their native son, and those in Michigan liked the new fella, too. Lake got 60% at home and 55% in Michigan, where Governor Terry got a paltry 31%. The balance was divided among the non-contenders. It was a devastating loss for Governor Terry just 2 weeks before Big Super Tuesday and 3 weeks before the little one. Lake watched the vote counting from onboard his airplane, en route from Phoenix, where he'd voted for himself. An hour from Washington, CNN declared him the surprise winner in Michigan, and his staff opened the champagne. He savored the moment, even allowed himself 2 glasses. History was not lost on Lake. No one had ever started so late and come so far so fast. In the darkened cabin, they watched the analysts on 4 screens, the experts all marveling at this man Lake and what he'd done. Governor Terry was gracious, but also worried about the enormous sums of money being spent by his heretofore unknown opponent. Lake chatted politely with the small group of reporters waiting for him at Reagan National Airport, then rode in yet another black Suburban to his national campaign headquarters, where he thanked his highly paid staff and told them to go home and get some sleep. It was almost midnight when he got to Georgetown, to his quaint little row house on 34th near Wisconsin. 2 Secret Service agents got out of the car behind Lake, and 2 more were waiting on the front steps. He had adamantly refused an official request to put guards inside his home. "I do not want to see you people lurking around here," he said harshly at his front door. He resented their presence, didn't know their names, and didn't care if they disliked him. They had no names, as far as he was concerned. They were simply, "you people," said with as much contempt as possible. Once he was locked inside, he went upstairs to his bedroom and changed clothes. He turned out the lights, as if he were asleep, waited 15 minutes, then eased downstairs to the den to see if anyone was looking in, then down another flight to the small basement. He climbed through a window and stepped into the cold night near his tiny patio. He paused, listened, heard nothing, then quietly opened a wooden gate and darted between the 2 buildings behind his. He surfaced on 35th Street, alone, in the dark, dressed like a jogger with a running cap pulled low to his brow. 3 minutes later, he was on M Street, in the crowds. He found a taxi and disappeared into the night. Teddy Maynard had gone to sleep reasonably content with his candidate's first two victories, but he was awakened by the news that something had gone wrong. When he rolled himself into the bunker at 10 minutes after 6 a.m., he was more frightened than angry, though his emotions had run the gamut in the past hour. York was waiting, along with a supervisor named DeVille, a tiny, nervous man who'd obviously been wired for many hours. "Let's hear it," Teddy growled, still rolling and looking for coffee. DeVille did the talking. At 12:02 this morning, he said goodbye to the Secret Service and entered his house. At 12:17, he exited through a small window in the basement. We, of course, have wires and timers on every door and window. We've leased a row house across the street, and we were on alert anyway. He hasn't been home in 6 days. DeVille waved a small pill the size of an aspirin caplet. "This is a little device known as a T-deck. They're in the soles of all his shoes, including his jogging shoes. So if he's not barefoot, we know where he is. Once pressure is applied from the foot, the bug emits a signal that is broadcast for 200 yards without a transmitter. When pressure is relaxed, it will continue to provide a signal for 15 minutes. We scrambled and picked him up on M Street. He was dressed in sweats with a cap over his eyes. We had two cars in place when he jumped in a cab. We followed him to Chevy Chase, to a suburban shopping center. While the cab waited, he darted into a place called Mailbox America, one of these new places where you can send and receive mail outside the postal service. Some, including this one, are open 24 hours for mail pickup. He was inside for less than a minute, just long enough to open his box with a key, remove several pieces of mail, throw it all away, then return to the cab. One of our cars followed him back to M Street, where he got out and sneaked back home. The other car stayed at the mailbox place. We went through the waste can just inside the door and found 6 pieces of junk mail, evidently his. The address is Al Conyers, Box 455, Mailbox America 39380, Western Avenue, Chevy Chase. "So, he didn't find what he was looking for?" Teddy asked. "It looks as though he tossed everything he took from his box. Here's the video." A screen dropped from the ceiling as the lights faded. Footage from a video camera zoomed across a parking lot, past the cab, and onto the figure of Aaron Lake in his baggy sweats as he disappeared around a corner inside Mailbox America. Seconds later, he reappeared, flipping through letters and papers in his right hand. He stopped briefly at the door and then dumped everything in a tall wastebasket. "What the hell's he looking for?" Teddy mumbled to himself. Lake left the building and quickly ducked inside the cab. The video stopped. The lights became brighter. DeVille resumed his narrative. "We're confident we found the right papers in the trash can. We were there within seconds and no one else entered the premises while we waited. The time was 12:58. An hour later, we entered again and keyed the lock to box 455, so we'll have access anytime we need it." "Check it every day," Teddy said. "Inventory every piece of mail. Leave the junk, but when something arrives, I want to know it." "You got it." Mr. Lake re-entered the basement window at 1:22 and stayed at home for the rest of the night. He's there now. "That's all," Teddy said, and DeVille left the room. A minute passed as Teddy stirred his coffee. How many addresses does he have? York knew the question was coming. He glanced at some notes. He gets most of his personal mail at his home in Georgetown. He has at least 2 addresses on Capitol Hill, one at his office, the other at the Armed Services Committee. He has 3 offices back home in Arizona. That's 6 that we know about. Why would he need a 7th? I don't know the reason, but it can't be good. A man who has nothing to hide does not use an alias or a secret address. When did he rent the box? We're still working on that. Maybe he rented the box after he decided to enter the race. He's got the CIA doing his thinking for him. So maybe he figures we're watching everything too. So he figures he might need a little privacy, thus the box. Maybe it's a girlfriend we missed somehow. Maybe he likes dirty magazines or videos, something that is shipped through the mail. After a long pause, York said, "Could be. What if the box was rented months ago, long before he entered the race? Then he's not hiding from us. He's hiding from the world, and his secret is truly dreadful." They silently contemplated the dreadfulness of Lake Secret, neither wanting to venture a guess. They decided to step up surveillance even more and to check the mailbox twice a day. Lake would be leaving town in a matter of hours, off to do battle in other primaries, and they would have the box to themselves. Unless someone else was also checking it for him. Aaron Lake was the man of the hour in Washington. From his office on Capitol Hill, he graciously granted live interviews to the early morning news programs. He received senators and other members of Congress, friends and former enemies alike, all bearing tidings of great joy and congratulations. He had lunch with his campaign staff and followed it with long meetings on strategy. After a quick dinner with Elaine Tyner, who brought wonderful news of tons of new cash over at DPAC, he left the city and flew to Syracuse to make plans for the New York primary. A large crowd welcomed him. He was, after all, now the front runner. Chapter 14. The hangovers were becoming more frequent, and as Trevor opened his eyes for another day, he told himself that he simply had to get a grip. You can't lay out at Pete's every night drinking cheap long necks with co-eds watching meaningless basketball games just because you got $1,000 on them. Last night it had been Logan State and somebody, some team with green uniforms. Who the hell cared about Logan State? Joe Roy Spicer, that's who. Spicer put $500 on him, Trevor backed it up with $1,000 of his own, and Logan won it for them. In the past week, Spicer had picked 10 out of 12 winners. He was up $3,000 in real cash, and Trevor, happily following along, was up $5,500 for himself. His gambling was proving to be much more profitable than his lawyering, and someone else was picking the winners. He went to the bathroom and splashed water on his face without looking at the mirror. The toilet was still clogged from the day before, and as he stomped around his dirty little house looking for a plunger, the phone rang. It was a wife from a previous life, a woman he loathed and one who loathed him, and when he heard her voice, he knew she needed money. He said no angrily and got in the shower. Things were worse at the office. A divorcing couple had arrived in separate cars to finish the negotiations for their property settlement. The assets they were fighting over were of no consequence to anyone else, pots, pans, a toaster, but since they had nothing, they had to fight over something. The fights are nastiest when the stakes are smallest. Their lawyer was an hour late, and they had used the time to simmer and boil until finally Jan had separated them. The wife was parked in Trevor's office when he stumbled in from the back door. "Where the hell you been?" she demanded, loud enough for her husband to hear up front. Husband charged down the hall past Jan, who did not give chase, and burst into Trevor's small office. "We've been waiting for an hour," he announced. "Shut up, both of you!" Trevor screamed, and Jan left the building. His clients were stunned at the volume. "Sit down!" he screamed again. And they fell into the only empty chairs. "You people pay $500 for a lousy divorce, and you think you own the place." They looked at his red eyes and red face, and decided this was not a man to mess with. The phone started ringing and no one answered it. Nausea hit again, and Trevor bolted out of his office and across the hall to the bathroom, where he puked as quietly as possible. The toilet failed to flush, the little metal chain clinking harmlessly inside the tank. The phone was still ringing. He stomped down the hall to fire Jan, and when he couldn't find her, he left the building too. He walked to the beach, took off his shoes and socks, and splashed his feet in the cool salt water. 2 hours later, Trevor sat motionless at his desk, door locked to keep out clients, bare feet on the desk, with sand still wedged between the toes. He needed a nap, and he needed a drink, and he stared at the ceiling trying to organize his priorities. The phone rang, this time duly answered by Jan, who was still employed but secretly checking want ads. It was Brashears in the Bahamas.
"We have a wire, sir," he said.
Trevor was instantly on his feet. "How much?"
$100,000, sir.
Trevor glanced at his watch. He had about an hour to catch a flight. "Can you see me at 3:30? He asked.
"Certainly, sir."
He hung up and yelled toward the front, "Cancel my appointments for today and tomorrow. I'm leaving."
"You don't have any appointments," Jan yelled back. "You're losing money faster than ever."
He wouldn't bicker. He slammed the back door and drove away. The flight to Nassau stopped first in Fort Lauderdale, though Trevor hardly knew it. After two quick beers, he was sound asleep. Two more over the Atlantic, and a flight attendant had to wake him when the plane was empty. The wire was from Curtis in Dallas, as expected. It was remitted by a Texas bank payable to Boomer Realty, care of Geneva Trust Bank, Nassau. Trevor raked his one-third off the top, again hiding $25,000 in his own secret account and taking $8,000 in cash. He thanked Mr. Brashears, said he hoped to see him soon, and staggered out of the building. The thought of going home had not crossed his mind. He headed for the shopping district, where packs of heavy American tourists choked the sidewalks. He needed shorts and a straw hat and a bottle of sunscreen. Trevor eventually made it to the beach, where he found a room in a nice hotel. $200 a night, but what did he care? He lathered himself in oil and stretched out by the pool close enough to the bar. A waitress in a thong fetched him drinks. He woke up after dark, sufficiently cooked but not burned. A security guard escorted him to his room, where he fell on the bed and returned to his coma. The sun was up again before he moved. After such a long period of rest, he awoke surprisingly clear-headed and very hungry. He ate some fruit and went looking for sailboats, not exactly shopping for one, but paying close attention to the details. A 30-footer would be sufficient, just large enough to live on, yet manageable by a crew of one. There would be no passengers, just the lonely skipper hopping from island to island. The cheapest one he found was $90,000, and it needed some work. Noon found him back at the pool with a cell phone trying to placate a client or two, but his heart wasn't in it. The same waitress brought another drink. Off the phone, he hid behind dark sunshades and tried to crunch the numbers. But things were wonderfully dull between his ears. In the past month, he'd earned about $80,000 in tax-free graft. Could the pace continue? If so, he'd have his $1 million in a year, and he could abandon his office and what was left of his career, and he could buy his little boat and hit the sea. For the first time ever, the dream seemed almost real. He could see himself at the wheel, shirtless, shoeless, cold beer at the ready, gliding across the water from St. Bart's to St. Kitts, from Nevis to St. Lucia, from one island to a thousand others, wind popping his mainsail, not a damn thing in the world to worry about. He closed his eyes and longed even harder for an escape. His snoring woke him. The thong was nearby. He ordered some rum and checked his watch. 2 days later, Trevor finally made it back to Trumbull. He arrived with mixed feelings. First, he was quite anxious to pick up the mail and facilitate the scam, anxious to keep the extortion going and the money rolling in. On the other hand, he was tardy, and Judge Spicer would not be happy.
"Where the hell you been?" Spicer growled at him as soon as the guard left the attorney conference room. It seemed to be the standard question these days.
"I've missed 3 games because of you, and I picked nothing but winners."
"The Bahamas. We got $100,000 from Curtis in Dallas."
Spicer's mood changed dramatically.
"It took 3 days to check on a wire in the Bahamas?" he asked.
"I needed a little rest. Didn't know I was supposed to visit this place every day."
Spicer was mellowing by the second. He just picked up another $22,000. It was safely tucked away with his other loot, in a place no one could find it, and as he handed the lawyer yet another stack of pretty envelopes, he was thinking of ways to spend the money.
"Aren't we busy?" Trevor said, taking the letters.
"Any complaints? You're making more than we are."
"I have more to lose than you do."
Spicer handed over a sheet of paper.
"I've picked 10 games here, $500 on each."
Great, thought Trevor, another long weekend at Pete's, watching one game after another. Oh well, there could be worse things.
They played blackjack at $1 a hand until the guard broke up the meeting. Trevor's increased visits had been discussed by the warden and the higher-ups at the Bureau of Prisons in Washington. Paperwork had been created on the subject, restrictions had been contemplated, but then abandoned. The visits were useless, and besides, the warden didn't want to alienate the brethren. Why pick a fight? The lawyer was harmless. After a few phone calls around Jacksonville, they decided that Trevor was basically unknown, and probably had nothing better to do than hang out in the attorney conference room of a prison. The money gave new life to Beach and Yarber. Spending it would necessarily entail getting to it, and that would require they one day walk away as free men, free to do whatever they wanted with their growing fortunes. With $50,000 or so now in the bank, Yarber was busy plotting an investment portfolio. No sense letting it sit there at 5% per annum, even if it was tax-free. One day, very soon, he'd roll it over into aggressive growth funds, with emphasis on the Far East. Asia would boom again, and his little pile of dirty money would be there to share in the wealth. He had 5 years to go, and if he earned between 12% and 15% on his money until then, the $50,000 would grow to roughly $100,000 by the time he left Trumbull. Not a bad start for a man who would be 65 and hopefully still in good health. But if he and Percy and Ricky could keep adding to the principal, he might indeed be rich when they turned him loose. 5 lousy years, months and weeks he'd been dreading. Now he was suddenly wondering if he had enough time to extort all he needed. As Percy, he was writing letters to over 20 pen pals across North America. No two were in the same town. It was Spicer's job to keep the victims separated. Maps were being used in the law library to make certain neither Percy nor Ricky was corresponding with men who appeared to live near one another. When he wasn't writing letters, Yarber caught himself thinking about the money. Thankfully, the divorce papers from his wife had come and gone. He'd be officially single in a few months, and by the time he was paroled, she'd have long since forgotten about him. Nothing would be shared. He'd be free to walk away without a single string attached. 5 years, and he had so much work to do. He'd cut out the sugar and walk an extra mile each day. In the darkness of his top bunk, during sleepless nights, Hatley Beach had done the same math as his colleagues. $50,000 in hand, a healthy rate of return somewhere, add to the principal by squeezing from as many victims as they could catch, and one day there'd be a fortune. Beach had 9 years, a marathon that once seemed endless. Now there was a flicker of hope. The death sentence they'd handed him was slowly becoming a time of harvest. Conservatively, if the scam netted him only $100,000 a year for the next 9 years, plus a healthy rate of return, then he'd be a multimillionaire when he danced through the gates, also at the age of 65. 2, 3, 4 million was not out of the question. He knew exactly what he'd do. Since he loved Texas, he'd go to Galveston and buy one of those old Victorians near the sea, and he'd invite old friends to stop by and see how rich he was. Forget the law, he'd put in 12-hour days working the money, nothing but work, nothing but money, so that by the time he was 70, he'd have more than his ex-wife. For the first time in years, Hatley Beach thought he might live to see 65, maybe 70. He, too, gave up sugar and butter, and he cut his cigarettes in half with the goal of going cold turkey real soon. He vowed to stay away from the infirmary and stop taking pills. He began walking a mile every day in the sun, like his colleague from California. And he wrote his letters, he and Ricky. And Justice Spicer, already equipped with sufficient motivation, was finding it difficult to sleep. He wasn't plagued by guilt or loneliness or humiliation, nor was he depressed by the indignity of prison. He was simply counting money and juggling rates of return and analyzing point spreads. With 21 months to go, he could see the end. His lovely wife Rita had passed through the week before, and they'd spent 4 hours together over 2 days. She'd cut her hair, stopped drinking, and lost 18 pounds, and she promised to be even skinnier when she picked him up at the front gate in less than 2 years. After 4 hours with her, Joe Roy was convinced the $90,000 was still buried behind the tool shed. They'd move to Vegas, buy a new condo, and say to hell with the rest of the world. With the Percy and Ricky scam working so well, Spicer had found a new worry. He'd leave Trumbull first, happily, gladly, without looking back, but what about the money to be made after he was gone? If the scam was still printing money, what would happen to his share of the future earnings, money he was clearly entitled to? It had been, after all, his idea, one he'd borrowed from the prison in Louisiana. Beach and Yarber had been reluctant conspirators at first. He had time to devise an exit strategy, just as he had time to contrive a way to get rid of the lawyer. But it would cost him some sleep. The letter from Quince Garby in Iowa was read by Beach. "Dear Ricky, or whoever the hell you are, I don't have any more money. The first $100,000 was borrowed from a bank using a bogus financial statement. I'm not sure how I'll pay it back. My father owns our bank and all its money. Why don't you write him some letters, you thug? I can possibly scrape together $10,000 if we can agree that the extortion will stop there. I'm on the verge of suicide, so don't push. You're scum, you know that. I hope you get caught. Sincerely, Quince Garby." "Sounds pretty desperate," Yarber said, looking up from his own pile of mail. Spicer said, toothpick hanging from his bottom lip, "Tell him we'll take $25,000. "I'll write him and tell him to wire it," Beach said, opening another envelope addressed to Ricky. Chapter 15. During lunch, when experience had shown that traffic picked up somewhat at Mailbox America, an agent nonchalantly entered the place behind two other customers, and for the second time that day placed a key in box 455. Lying on top of 3 pieces of junk mail, one from a pizza carryout, one from a car wash, one from the U.S. Postal Service, he noticed something new. It was an envelope, light orange in color, 5x8. With a pair of tweezers he kept on his key ring, he clamped the end of the envelope, slid it quickly from the box, and dropped it in a small leather briefcase. The junk mail was left undisturbed. At Langley, it was carefully opened by experts. Two handwritten pages were removed and copied. An hour later, DeVille entered Teddy's bunker holding a file. DeVille was in charge of what was commonly referred to deep inside Langley as the Lake Mess. He gave copies of the letter to Teddy and York, then scanned it to a large screen where Teddy and York at first just stared at it. The printing was bold, in block form, easily readable, as if the author had labored over each word. It read, "Dear Al, where you been? Did you get my last letter? I wrote 3 weeks ago and I haven't heard a word. I guess you're busy, but please don't forget about me. I get very lonely here and your letters have always inspired me to keep going. They give me strength and hope because I know somebody out there cares. Please don't give up on me, Al. My counselor says that I might be released in 2 months. There's a halfway house in Baltimore, actually a few miles from where I grew up, and the people here are trying to get me a spot there. It would be for 90 days, enough time for me to find a job, some friends, etc. You know, get used to society again. It's a lockdown place at night, but I'd be free during the day. There aren't many good memories, Al. Every person who ever loved me is now dead, and my uncle, the guy who's paying for this rehab, is very rich but very cruel. I need friends so desperately, Al. By the way, I've lost another 5 pounds, and my waist is now a 32. The photo I sent you is getting outdated. I've never liked the way my face looks in it, too much flesh on the cheeks. I'm much leaner now, and tanned. They let us tan for up to 2 hours a day here, weather permitting. It's Florida, but some days are too cool. I'll send you another photo, maybe one from the chest up. I'm lifting weights like crazy. I think you'll like the next photo. You said you would send me one of you. I'm still waiting. Please don't forget me, Al. I need one of your letters. Love, Ricky." Since York had had the responsibility of investigating every aspect of Lake's life, he felt compelled to try and speak first. But he could think of nothing to say. They read the letter in silence again and again. Finally, DeVille broke the ice by saying, "Here's the envelope." He flashed it on the wall. It was addressed to Mr. Al Conyers at Mailbox America. The return address was Ricky, Aladdin North, P.O. Box 44683, Neptune Beach, Florida, 32233. "It's a front," DeVille said. "There's no such place as Aladdin North. There's a telephone number and you get an answering service. We've called 10 times with questions, but the operators know nothing. We've called every rehab and treatment clinic in North Florida, and no one's heard of this place." Teddy was silent, still staring at the wall. "Where's Neptune Beach?" York grunted. "Jacksonville." DeVille was excused but told to stand by. Teddy began making notes on a green legal pad. "There are other letters, and at least one photo," he said, as if the problem were just part of the routine. Panic was a state unknown to Teddy Maynard. "We have to find them," he said. "We've done 2 thorough searches of his home," York said. "Then do a third. I doubt if he would keep such stuff at his office." "How soon?" "Do it now. Lake is in California, looking for votes. We have no time on this, York. There may be other secret boxes, other men writing letters and bragging about their tans and waistlines. Do you confront him?" "Not yet." Since they had no sample of Mr. Conyers' handwriting, DeVille made a suggestion that Teddy eventually liked. They would use the ruse of a new laptop, one with a built-in printer. The first draft was composed by DeVille and York, and after an hour or so, the fourth draft read as follows. "Dear Ricky, I got your letter of the 22nd. Forgive me for not writing sooner. I've been on the road a lot lately, and I'm behind on everything. In fact, I'm writing this letter at 35,000 feet, somewhere over the Gulf, en route to Tampa. And I'm using a new laptop, one so small it almost fits in my pocket. Amazing technology. The printer leaves something to be desired. I hope you can read it okay. Wonderful news about your release and the halfway house in Baltimore. I have some business interests there, and I'm sure I can help you find a job. Keep your head up. Only 2 months to go. You're a much stronger person now, and you're ready to live life to its fullest. Don't be discouraged. I'll help in any way possible. When you get to Baltimore, I'll be happy to spend some time with you, show you around, you know. I promise I'll write sooner. I can't wait to hear from you. Love, Al. They decided Al was in a hurry and forgot to sign his name. The letter was printed, marked up, revised, redrafted, pored over with more care than a treaty. The final version was printed on a piece of stationery from the Royal Sonesta Hotel in New Orleans and placed in a thick, plain brown envelope with optic wiring hidden along the bottom edge. In the lower right-hand corner, in a spot that looked as if it had been slightly damaged and knotted in transit, a tiny transmitter the size of a pinhead was installed. When activated, it would send a signal 100 yards for up to 3 days. Since Al was traveling to Tampa, the envelope was stamped with a Tampa postmark dated that day. This was done in less than half an hour by a team of very strange people down in documents on the second floor. At 4 p.m., a green van with many miles on it stopped at the curb in front of Aaron Lake's townhouse, near one of the many shade trees on 34th, in a lovely section of Georgetown. Its door advertised a plumbing company in the district. 4 plumbers got out and began removing tools and equipment. After a few minutes, the only neighbor who'd noticed grew bored and returned to her television. With Lake in California, the Secret Service was with him, and his home had yet to qualify for round-the-clock surveillance, at least by the Secret Service. That scrutiny would come quickly, though. The ploy was a clogged sewer line in the small front lawn, something that could be done without entering the home. An outside job, one that would pacify the Secret Service in case they happened to drop by. But 2 of the plumbers did indeed enter the home with their own keys. Another van stopped by to check on progress and to drop off a tool. 2 plumbers from the second van mixed with those already there, and a regular unit began to form. Inside the house, 4 of the agents began their tedious search for hidden files. They moved from room to room, inspecting the obvious, prying for the secrets. The second van left, and a 3rd one came from the other direction and parked with its tires on the sidewalk, as service vans often do. 4 more plumbers joined the sewer cleaning, and 2 eventually drifted inside. After dark, a spotlight was rigged in the front yard over the sewer cover and directed into the home so the lights inside would not be noticed. The 4 men left outside, sipped coffee and told jokes, and tried to stay warm. Neighbors hurried by on foot. After 6 hours, the sewer was clean, as was the home. Nothing unusual was found, certainly no hidden file with correspondence from one Ricky in rehab. No sign of a photo. The plumbers turned off their lights, packed their tools, and disappeared without a trace. At 8:30 the next morning, when the doors opened at the Neptune Beach post office, an agent named Barr walked hurriedly in as if he were late for something. Barr was an expert on locks and keys, and he'd spent 5 hours the previous afternoon at Langley studying various boxes used by the Postal Service. He had 4 master keys, one of which he was certain would open number 44683. If not, he'd be forced to key it, which might take 60 seconds or so and could possibly draw attention. The 3rd key worked, and Barr placed the brown envelope, postmarked the day before from Tampa, addressed to Ricky with no last name, care of Aladdin North, inside the box. There were 2 other letters already there. For good measure, he removed a piece of junk mail, then closed the door to the box, wadded up the mail, and threw it in the wastebasket.
This book is continued on Disc 5.